I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When did you first learn about the growing threat of climate change? Depending on where you grew up and when, you may have been oblivious to the phenomenon for a long time. Today, how two high school teachers in Kansas City are approaching this urgent issue in their classrooms. They have to be sensitive to emotional impact and must tailor their lesson plans for diverse student experiences. Then, the mastermind behind an exhibit that walked across the grounds of the Nelson Atkins Museum. As the walking wall makes its way into the permanent collection, we'll find out what it's taken to get there. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Climate change remains a tough conversation for many adults, so how do teachers handle the issue in the classroom? Yes, that can be a sticky subject. One of our guests today said she received all manner of pushback when she assigned a climate change essay in class in the Green Valley District. Some students wound up quoting the Bible to say that climate change wasn't an issue. Parents complained, and she was called into the principal's office. Now, a conversation about how climate change is taught in schools, why it can be difficult, and why it's so important. With us, Sarah Apple is a biology teacher at Raytown High School. She once taught in Green Valley and struggled to teach this issue. Sarah, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jen Lacey is an environmental science teacher at Crossroads Preparatory Academy. She joins us via Skype this morning. Jen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Michael Wysession is also with us. He's a geophysics professor at Washington University in St. Louis, who's worked to create the next generation science standards. He joins us from St. Louis Public Radio. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sir, I'm wondering if you anticipated the blowback you received for teaching climate change out in Green Valley.
Yes. When we first started this process over 10 years ago at the National Academy of Science, we were very aware that there are political factors that can interfere with science education. We had been familiar with this for decades with teaching evolution in the schools, and we had very much braced ourselves for that. We were surprised at the large level of organized pushback from a political nature against the teaching of climate science, at very much at a state-by-state level. For most states, this has not been an issue, but for some states, it very much
right.
has.
Sarah, what was your experience out in Green Valley, and were you surprised by what happened out there?
I was. Now, this was, I will say, 10 years ago.
Okay.
So just to give that context. But yeah, about 10 years ago, I did assign a sort of research paper. Students were asked to do their own research, argumentative essay, cite their evidence. And apparently, a parent did complain to a school board member at church. And then the principal, you know, had a conversation with me about, you know, why I was assigning this. Students did want to, not all students, but there were some students who did try and cite the Bible as one of their sources and then would get very, you know, emotional and upset when you try and explain that the Bible is not a scientific source of information. And so then some of them would get emotional and say I was attacking their religious beliefs.
Wow. Jen, are you surprised when you hear about Sarah's experience?
I'm not. I would say 12 years ago, I was in a small rural district close to Kansas City as well. And I also had some parents call me. They didn't go through the administration, but just asked if I would be teaching what they thought was the other side of the story or the biblical side. And I said the same thing that I teach science and that would not be a part of my curriculum.
Michael, how are we faring in Missouri and Kansas when it comes to teaching global warming? What's been your sense of it?
Well, basically, it's been very positive in recent years because, of course, both states now include a large amount of science concerning climate as part of the state standards upon which students and schools will be assessed. And so this is a real key sort of victory for science in order to make sure that these standards get into the state standards. Of course, you may know it's illegal in America to have a national science curriculum. Mm-hmm. Every state has the right to determine what is taught and assessed in their own state. However, these new set of standards called the Next Generation Science Standards have been adopted verbatim by 20 states and Washington, D.C., and one of those states is Kansas. And another 24 states, including Missouri, have adapted those NGSS standards with very slight modifications. In Missouri's case, all of those climate standards for middle school and high school and elementary school are there in the curriculum. And so this is there will be a transition period that will take many years for this content and also the scientific practices, the pedagogy, how students learn science, which is also very revolutionary, rolls in. That will take a while, but I'm very confident that because it's required by the state, that this will happen.
Sir, what's your reaction to that? I imagine that's got to be good news to you, what Michael just said.
It's great news, and we are seeing those changes. I'm at the high school level, and I teach biology. I do know that the earth science standards most specifically include climate change, which we are seeing in the middle school level. The hard part of the high school level is that earth science is typically an elective, so not very many students actually end up in that course, in which case it's possible that the only real standards they see are at the middle school level. And in biology, it absolutely works to tie in climate change, but the standards don't necessarily specify that. We have adopted a resource this past year, the HMH Science Dimensions, which is aligned with the NGSS, and they do an excellent job of bringing climate change into that discussion.
I'm wondering, sir, when did you start teaching climate change in the classroom?
Oh, gosh. Honestly, I don't remember. It's obviously at least 10 years ago, probably more than that, yeah.
Jen, how about you, and how was your work received when you started?
I started teaching climate change in 2006, and that was really when Al Gore's documentary Inconvenient Truth came out, and people started talking about that famous graph that they show with temperature and CO2. And at that school, I was at a rural school, and there was a little resistance from students. And also, I think it was the first time students were hearing about climate change. But over the years, I teach it now, and the students, I think because our current environmental movement is very much led by teenagers,
right,
that students are very excited about it. They want to sign up for environmental science. And there's also a lot more resources being created to make teaching climate change easier and more relevant for young people.
Sarah, are you seeing the same thing, that young people are, in fact, drawn to that that topic and want to take it if they can?
I do think that they are much more interested in the issue today. And from my perspective, I always try and come at it with current events. And there is constantly something going on in the news that you can easily tie to climate change. And so when you bring it in from a current events perspective, they tend to get a little bit more interested because it does seem very now. It's happening right now.
Yeah. You know, Jen, the fact that we can't visualize the phenomenon, I guess, you know, to some extent we can here in the heartland as it gets warmer, but we can't visualize it as well as people can on the coast. Does that make it tougher to teach this topic?
I think it makes it tougher for students to, yes, connect with the issues. But I also think that I try to bring in a lot of the human stories that go along with climate change. And so a good example of that, when Hurricane Harvey hit the Houston area, Of course, we talked about how storms are getting stronger. We're seeing more coastal flooding. And we looked at how flooding caused Superfund sites to leak toxic waste into the local waterway. And then we started mapping, well, flooding is happening more in Missouri as well. Where are those Superfund sites? And right. So I think there are ways to find connections between things that are happening on the coast to things that can happen in Missouri if climate change continues as it is and we see more and more flooding.
Michael, in St. Louis, for example, since 1960, over the course of my lifetime, average annual temperatures have gone up 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And so even here in the heartland, there are significant changes in climate that are happening over just a lifetime. And of course, all of the severe flooding that we saw over the last couple of years here is a direct result of it. So we very much feel it here in the heartland as well. But if I could come back to one point that Sarah said that's really important, and that is traditionally earth science has not been taught in the high school. And this is a major problem with these new standards that are taking hold nationally because they involve about a year's worth of earth and space science content in high school, a year's worth of life science, and a year's worth of physical science, about a semester of chemistry and a semester of physics. This is what's required for all students. This isn't honors or AP. This is what all students should be getting. And how do you do this if you haven't traditionally taught earth science? Well, one thing that I'm really optimistic about is that all of the textbook companies and curriculum developers are now changing their biology, chemistry, and physics courses to incorporate about earth science to be about a third of each. So, for instance, mm-hmm. I just co-authored a large high school chemistry program, a third of which is earth science. And in fact, there are over 100 pages on climate and climate change in that high school chemistry book. Mm-hmm. So students taking their traditional biochem physics classes in high school will get all of this climate content. And all of the textbook companies are moving in this direction. It takes time to develop these curricular materials, but I'm very confident that in a small amount of time, all of our students will actually be getting, you know, rigorous, right. scientifically accurate climate science.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about the challenge of teaching climate science in the classroom. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Sarah, how often does climate change become politicized in your classroom? Do you have those kinds of discussions?
At this time, where I teach now, it does not come up very often.
Right. Most students have bought into the idea that this, in fact, is the reality out there.
Yes. I've also changed my approach some in the sense that I really don't indulge argument on the topic at this point. You know, I can pretty quickly go through biogeochemical cycles, demonstrate the carbon cycle, and pretty quickly they can figure out why there's an issue. Mm-hmm. So it's a really pretty simple concept to teach in terms of the carbon cycle and the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere. And they've all experienced a hot car with the windows rolled up on a hot day. And so you can use those analogies and get them there pretty quick. So I don't see too much resistance these days, no.
Jen, same thing for you?
I don't see much resistance. I definitely teach the science, but I think for students to be really bought in, I bring in human stories. And so I think the most difficult thing about teaching climate change is the reason we're experiencing climate change is partly because of bigger issues like colonialism and capitalism and the effects we've seen since the Industrial Revolution. And so in order to create that bigger picture for students and for them to be able to connect the dots between different systems, between our government and our economy and social things, even like environmental racism, I think... for one, there, as a science teacher, I have to find those resources. Mm-hmm. And because of the way high schools are set up, I don't have time, or there's not space in the curriculum for me to collaborate with the social studies teacher to help bring in that much broader view of what's happening with climate change.
That's interesting. Michael, I imagine that things can get even more heated in a college classroom. Do you have much resistance to these conversations?
Oh, quite the contrary. No, there is no debate at mm-hmm. a university level, okay. at a scientific level about climate and its importance and role. And I think what's critical is what was just mentioned about the importance of broadening out beyond your disciplinary silo. I mean, the reason St. Louis, the reason all of Missouri became a state was because of climate change. You know, climate has been changing throughout the planet's history. Life has co-evolved with it. Civilizations have risen and fallen because of it. Volcanic eruption in Indonesia in 1815, Mount Tambora, totally altered the world's climate, caused the year without a summer in New England in 1816. Hmm. It snowed in the summer. New Englanders and East Coast people were starving, fled west in caravans, and Indiana became a state in 1816, Illinois in 1818, and Missouri in 1821 by those starving Easterners because their agriculture had collapsed as a result of climate change.
I've not heard that story before. That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
And so the Earth's climate changes through this complex set of factors, which actually makes it a wonderful capstone course for high school science, mm-hmm. because you really need to understand chemistry and physics and biology and planetary science and how the sun works, all of that, to understand our climate system. However, as was just mentioned, because of human actions and the fact that we are now the largest agent of geologic change by about a whole order of magnitude, we now drive the climate system. And so the change that we're seeing is very much a result of our actions.
Teaching climate change is our topic. Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Richard from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I was born and raised in Southern Baptist, and my parents taught me early on that the Bible is man's explanation of spirituality and has no purpose whatsoever with regard to science. If it did, the first few sections of Genesis would fill a library. Hmm. This is what drives me craziest about people who are on the ultra right who want to control politics and or how we deal with science,
yeah,
based on Genesis.
Yeah, Richard, thanks. Sarah, do you want to respond to that?
Oh, I agree completely. And I have spent, especially, about 10 years ago, spent a lot of time trying to get students to understand that science and religion do not have to compete, that they can work together, but ultimately they are two very different, separate things that have different purposes. And so it's important to keep that in mind.
Let's go to Rick here from Independence. Rick, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to commend our teachers for having the fortitude to bring this issue into the classroom. Betsy DeVos, of course, with opportunity, would slap their hands. But moreover, the important thing that our scholars are telling us today is that this is no longer a change. The change began over 50 years ago when oil company scientists made this discovery. Mm-hmm. But today it's not a matter of change. The narrative our scholars are telling us is this is an emergency. It's a climate emergency, and that's how we should be dealing with it, in the same manner that we have a nuclear emergency.
Yeah.
Destroying all of our protections that reasonably protected us from nuclear catastrophe are being destroyed here in the last couple of years.
Rick, I'm going to have to scoot on, but I appreciate your comments. Thanks for calling in. Larry from Lenexa. Larry, you're on the show.
This is a question for the faculty members.
Yeah.
You historically mentioned a few minutes ago about population shift due to Tambora and winter, but as climate changes, there's going to be a tremendous amount of population disruption. Is there any plans on discussing that and predicting what's going to happen with that in classroom teaching?
Right. Larry, thank you. Michael, do you want to take that?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, one of the some of the best plans are being done, for instance, at the Pentagon with their military war games. The U.S. military takes climate change very seriously. First of all of our Navy bases are at sea level, and they are terrified of sea level rise, literally flooding their bases in a short amount of time. But there are places around the world, one of the top of the list of the Pentagon scenarios internationally, for instance, is the Ganges Delta, Bangladesh, where you have 150 million Muslims living in essentially one river delta. Imagine half the population of the United States living in one river delta that is essentially at sea level. And it is surrounded on three sides by Hindu Indians. And if the sea level goes up enough that these people are flooded out and have a mass migration into Hindu lands, the potential for sort of a military flashpoint there is severe. And these sorts of scenarios are being thought about and planned about. There are a lot of them, and that's the challenge.
Jen Lacey at the Crossroads Preparatory Academy, do you teach these kinds of ideas that Michael just threw out in your environmental justice approach to this issue?
Yeah, definitely. We have just finished a unit on ocean warming and acidification and how it's affecting the coral reefs. And then we looked at how the human population that lives around the Philippines, the coral triangle there, they rely so heavily on fish. And so how they're already seeing people migrating more inland where there's more food and economic opportunity as the fishing industry declines. Also, in the past, I've talked about Syria and the effects of drought and the impact it's had on the war that's currently occurring there. We talk about...
And Central America, too. Very similar. Yes.
Yeah. We talk about how climate change is also a military security issue, and that there are climate refugees and that governments are figuring out how to respond so that wars don't break out.
Right.
When people don't think their government is responding like they should be.
Sarah Apple, again, at Raytown High School. You know, this problem and this issue is so severe, and it can be so scary. I'm wondering, how do you ensure, or do you feel that it's your job to ensure that your students don't wind up losing hope for their futures?
Real quick, I'm at Raytown South High School.
Raytown
I just
South.
Want to be clear, because
yes.
That's a rivalry. So
yes, it is. Yeah.
It is a fine line. Trying to break through the noise. I mean, students are in classes all day long learning all kinds of stuff. So trying to break through the noise and get them to understand how important this issue is. This is really urgent. This is really important. But you don't want to scare them, because a lot of times when you scare people too much, then they can just kind of give up, shut down. And so it really is important to try and, I guess, moderate to some extent how you teach the topic.
Mm-hmm. Jen, how about you? How do you handle that?
Yeah, I always try to balance my curriculum with signs of hope and how that there are people fighting against climate change and working to mitigate it in positive ways that have bettered their community. So currently right now we're looking at the agricultural industry and just ways that people in urban areas and are turning to methods that don't release as much greenhouse gases, but that are also boosting their economy and people are eating better. So trying to find those stories of hope to counter the real realities, the harsh realities of climate change.
Now, Michael, wrap this up for us. How do you handle this idea of not losing hope at the college level?
That is so critical, and that was forefront on our minds when the Next Generation Science Standards were written. And I think the key to that is the incorporation throughout the standards of the design principles of engineering. So, I mean, the stuff is in there. We don't shy away from the science, sea level change, global change, but everything is challenges the students to think about designing solutions. So from kindergarten to high school, when these topics come up, it's not just, oh, look what's happening, but how do you fix this? How do you design a solution? How do you mitigate it? And so, you know, they start small with maybe how they change their kitchen, their, you know, school cafeteria practices. But then as they go through the curriculum, middle school and high school, they think of solutions on a broader level. And having, I think, for the first time, these aspects of engineering and design incorporated in the science allow students to look at these from a perspective of building these solutions, as opposed to just understanding the problems. And I think this makes a huge difference.
That was the voice of Michael Weisesch, and he's a geophysics professor at Washington University over in St. Louis. We were also joined today by Sarah Apple, who teaches biology at Raytown South High School, and Jen Lacey at the Crossroads Preparatory Academy. She teaches environmental science. Thank you all so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk to the mastermind behind the walking wall at the Nelson Atkins. That's Andy Goldsworthy. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you haven't signed up yet for Kraske Off Mic, you're missing out. My weekly newsletter offers behind-the-scenes extras and my insights on the news and current events of the day. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. It's quick and easy, kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow and Friday, we're off for the holiday, but join us next week for an inside look at the life of longtime Kansas City music reviewer and friend of this show, Bill Brownlee. This man goes to more concerts than anyone else I know. We'll talk to him next week here on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the walking wall at the Nelson Atkins is on the move again, and it's nearing its final stage. Andy Goldsworthy's much-talked-about installation is now on the south side of the museum, and it's heading for its permanent placement inside and outside of the Block Building. If you haven't heard about the wall, it is just what it sounds like, a moving rock barrier that began east of the museum, crossed Rock Hill Road, and moved up the hill onto the museum's main campus on the building's north side. It then moved down a flight of steps and onto the museum's big south side. It involves workers adding to the wall's front end by taking stones from its back end. Plans call for the part of the wall to eventually walk into the museum with a trailing portion remaining outside. It's big, it's bold, it's unusual, it's just not a little bit audacious, and it's very much the vision of the highly regarded Andy Goldsworthy, who joins me here back in the studio. Andy, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
You know, you're in the final stages of this project. How has it developed from your standpoint? Has it been what you hoped it would be?
Oh, I think it's become far greater than I ever hoped.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think I said to you right back at the beginning that it was, you know, I've been launching myself into new territory here. The wall itself, where it goes, how it's responded to.
Because you didn't know where it was going to go when you started. I don't think, not exactly.
Not exactly. No, it found its way as it went along, and it really has gone on a journey, and it's taken me with it, obviously.
Mm-hmm. What have you learned from this one, from this particular project? You've done so many. What has this one brought to you?
Well, I think that this one is really, you know, I'm known as an artist for the making work with leaves and snow and whatever, things that disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big projects like the Storm King Wall that are there permanently. And this is between the two in a way. It talks about change. It talks about the passing of time, passing of buildings, passing of materials, passing of people. And so it's between the two. So it's not just the stone that is the work. It's the presence that is the story that is left behind. And I think this wall has had a great life as it's made its way to the museum. And whilst that's the end of its journey, it will then begin its life as a work that will be in that place for a long time.
What has struck you about the impact this project has had on the community, Kansas City, at writ large here?
Well, I think the most people have responded with amazing open-mindedness and enjoyment of Wall. And, you know,
It's on one level, it's a very strange concept.
It's a tough ask, and it's an ask that has not really landed fruitfully in other places, because trying to wrap your head around, why are we taking down this sculpture to build it? And, it's a little confusing. But there's been a huge level of comprehension about and not just about the mechanics of taking down the back end and feeding the front end, but what that means, what that really means.
What does it mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know, but there's this feeling, and that's what I love, is that my interpretation is not the only one out there, and it's been enriched by the interpretation of so many people who've come there, and so from the pastor who based his sermon on the walking wall. You know, people have stood there, looked and listened, and taken away all sorts of responses and feelings towards the wall, and that's made it a very rich story that it's had and will leave behind, and it's still part of it.
You know, the craftsmanship involved in the building of this thing is so striking to me. It's so lovely to look at. It's so perfect on so many levels. You know, I was out there yesterday watching you work in the cold and talking to someone who again said to me, you know, there's so much labor is going into this, and yet it's being taken apart as it's moving along. And people struggle with that idea here in the heartland. We're hardworking people, and there's something disruptive to that idea.
Well, it possibly is. And, you know, and I think walls and the making of this work is disruptive. It's confrontational at times, and it's challenging at times, and it is sometimes you walk with the wall and sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's in your way. And I have to say, I think the Nelson Atkins have been extraordinary in they've put no signs up, no warning, no apology that warn you that if you go up those stairs, you won't be able to actually go any further. You'll have to walk down again.
Yes.
You know? So people have...
I did that yesterday. Yeah.
People have met the wall, the wall and them. It's just themselves and the wall. And it's remarkable that that has been allowed to happen, and that it's not heavily guarded, it's not heavily policed.
Right.
And people just hang out, watch the wall being made. And then there's wonderful moments when people come for the first time. And what is this? You know, I was there one morning really early. I was photographed at night as well as in the day. I think it was like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow!
And it was the bottom of the where it went down the stairs, and there's this little kink in the wall where the wall is on the landing, and it's dark. And this fairly elderly guy walked up and he said, "What's this wall doing here?"
At 4 o'clock in the morning. You know,
and when was this put here? You know, and the beauty is because I mean you know I know that it's moving, but even to us, even those people who know it's moving, it still doesn't move. But then it's moved when you come back. It's moving at an incredible pace.
Yeah,
but doesn't move at all at the same time. And people meet it and think, well, it's a wall, so it must be there permanent. They don't read it as being something that won't. But then you look at the greater city and the Nelson, you know, the Nelson Atkins Museum itself, which was built on Nelson, Rockhill Nelson's old house.
That's right.
It's part of a city, this rebuilding and unbuilding.
You know, before I forget to ask, if people want to come out and see you in these final phases of the project, when are you going to be out there over the Thanksgiving holiday?
We won't be there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We're going to
celebrate.
We're going to be part of
the American holiday.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. and we're out there every day until the wall is finished, which will be on the 4th.
On the 4th of December.
Yeah.
Because in my notes, I went through them and I noted that your original plan was to wrap it up on November 30th, which obviously is just 3 days from now. you aren't going to make it by the original plan.
No. Well, we changed that in response to the museum wanting to coordinate the end of the project with the meeting of the board and this big event for the museum.
Uh-huh.
And the museum had been absolutely fantastic. So it just seemed like a reasonable thing. So we agreed to change the timings so long as we got a Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, as long as you get that. I'm visiting with Andy Goldsworthy with The Walking Wall. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Do the workers get frustrated with what you're doing, the building and the unbuilding?
No. I mean, that's the remarkable thing, is that they build it with the same conviction as if it was permanent.
Seems that way.
But you know, in the bigger picture, but that's what we do in life. We build things and we take them down. But it's not as if it's lost. It remains part of our history, our memories, and the story this wall leaves behind is, as I said, as important as the stone.
You know, we talked the first time you were on this summer about this idea that the Hall family made this as a gift to the museum and to the city on behalf of Morton Sosland, who saw the early phase of this project and then passed away fairly early on. But you said at the time, and it's worth repeating again, Morton bought into this hook, line, and sinker real fast. He didn't hesitate at all when you explained to him what you wanted to do.
No, it was quite extraordinary response.
He got it. Yeah.
Well, it was one. The Walking Wall was one of several ideas that I proposed for the museum for Morton and Nistelle. And this was by far the most difficult, the most challenging, the work that I was in there. And he just loved it.
What were the other options you presented him with, you just roughly?
Well, I kind of was interested in the drains.
The drains?
Well, the interface between the surface and what lies below. So I was going to make sculptures that sucked the water from the place. So
really?
You know, that was kind of an interesting idea. And then there was a possibility of making a stone wave. A kind of a arch, but almost like a tunnel.
Huh.
That would be as if the stone's rising up out of the ground. And you know what I love about the Midwest and the stone here? It is the sea. It was the sea.
Right.
As far as we are from the sea. And I think that underlying fluidity and movement is so deep.
That's a neat
and
idea.
So evocative of, I think, the Midwest character.
Yeah.
Slow moving, deep, and very beautiful, this kind of rhythm, that underlying rhythm. It's understated. And it's like the Flint Hills, where the stone came from, is so rich and deep, and in its own way, one of the most spectacular places in the U.S. But it's not the Rockies.
Right.
It's got this deep heart to it. So this work would have been somewhat touching on that.
We'll look forward to having you come back in 3 or 4 years to do that, Andy.
Well, actually,
don't rule it out.
I'm working on it, and I've been in.
Are you?
Yeah, no. Fortunately, the Nelson Atkins didn't go for that idea because it was in an early stage, and I wouldn't really know how to. And it was a very
you didn't know what you were going to do. You just
well,
liked
no,
the idea,
I didn't know how I was going to make it, but it would have been a fairly small affair. Well. Having gone back to the Flint Hills and got the stone for here and met with Alex Gnatt and Flint Hill Stone, this wonderful quarry and this guy who has got all the helped me with the stone there, took me back to an abandoned quarry where I got stone for the Wichita Arch, which I made many, many years ago. And in that quarry, came the proposal, the idea to make a sea of stone arches that eventually went to St. Louis Art Museum and is in a courtyard there. So this area has kind of generated a lot of ideas to do with limestone and movement of stone. So, and I have worked in limestone at Des Moines, and I said St. Louis, and Wichita, and now Nelson Atkins. So I would love to anchor all these works in a place where the stone came from. So I would love to make the big stone wave. in the bottom of this quarry where the stone came from.
Are you going to do it?
I'm going to propose the idea. I don't know, you know, if anyone will, but it is a beautiful idea.
And you would do it down in the Flint Hills at the quarry itself?
In the quarry itself.
Oh, yeah. What a neat idea.
Well, it would be. I think it would really, as I say, anchor all these works together and put it back in that context. And where things come from, the journeys they make, is really important to me. And that seems so right for me as an artist to do that.
That's such an amazing place, the Flint Hills of Kansas. So undervalued in some ways, but every time I go through it, I'm just awestruck by just how amazing it is. Just incredible. Andy Goldsworthy is my guest. He's doing The Walking Wall at the Nelson Atkins. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. So what was the challenge of this current project, The Walking Wall, because you came across Rock Hill Road, you went up the hill, you wound your way in between the old original Nelson Atkins Museum and the block building. Then you went down this set of steps, which I remember walking down when the wall was on the steps and thinking to myself, how much weight is on these steps as a result of this walking wall? Do you know how much it was? And did you have to reinforce those steps? And was it safe to walk down those steps during that time?
Oh, the steps were perfectly sound. Steve Waterman from the Nelson Atkins is too smart and good at these things not to let me get it. No, I mean, the problems that it's encountered and the overcoming of the problems, which is all part of the work, has been quite extraordinary with the Nelson. When we took the stone through the building, and the suggestion came from, we were all standing on the stairs thinking, how are we going to get the stone down here? And then someone from inside the building said, why don't you bring it through the building? And that, up till then I thought, well, they won't let me do that. But then I went and asked Steve, and his response was, well, actually, that'd be really interesting for people to see that, for the stone to be wheelbarrowed. And I think that is why the museum has been such a great institution to work with, and he took out a window so we could get in and take the stone through a building. It was quite extraordinary. And on this trip, the going down the stairs, we had to block that window up, so we had to actually carry the stone down the stairs this time. And we thought of all sorts of ways to achieve that, with pulleys and what have you. And in the end, we just got seven guys on the steps, three at one end, three at the other, and we just fireman lifted it down. And we got it so easily. And I think that's been one of the big lessons for me, is the ease at which you can do things and what you can achieve with people and will and hard work.
Well, the people you have doing this for you are extraordinary craftsmen. These are not just guys off the street. These are people who know what they're doing, Andy. Well, you brought them over from England, right?
There's two, three guys from England, mm-hmm. and one from Scotland, and mm-hmm. two guys are putting the stone on the wall. And the way that they make the wall, the human effort, the movement of the stone, that's all part of the work. But it... And it's also been quite a revelation of how each stage has had its own very distinct character and story. You know, the first stage was over the other side of the road with the neighbors and how this would resolve. There were some issues between the neighbor, and it was such a great kind of coming together over the wall. And then crossing the road, blocking a four-lane road, which people, I was in New York on the way here, and they said, you really blocked a road?
Yes.
I said, yeah, no
Boy,
problem.
Did you ever.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, apart from the few shouts of abuse that I told you about at the last conversation, from people in cars, you know.
Well, what did the one guy shout at
you? Oh, it says, loser.
Loser, yeah, that's
and,
it.
And, and then another one said, nobody cares.
Yeah.
It was such a really funny.
That's right.
It was
that's
a
right.
really, really funny kind of comments. But yeah. I think anybody who actually got to the wall on their feet felt so liberated about being on a street that they really embraced and enjoyed this. And it is quite remarkable to the, and a testament to the broad-minded and open-mindedness of the people of Kansas City
yeah.
to ideas and things that are unusual. And that was amazing. So I got through that. You know, it was quite a relief in a way. Phew, you know, I didn't get lynched. and then I'm into the home ground of the museum itself for the next stage. Yeah. So then there's this point where the wall is actually blocking off the whole of the front. And it's really hot. And people in Kansas City get really cranky when it's hot.
Yeah.
And the museum's really cool and it's, you know, the air conditioning. Mm-hmm. So people are heading towards the museum and they're really hot and then they meet a wall.
Yeah.
And that's when people got really angry.
That wasn't
that
good.
That is all part of the work. There was this moment where it really did cause me, even though he said, oh, you just have to go, you know, it's only around. What? There's a wall. It was a really important moment, and there's no getting away with it. There will be times. Well, it will create difficulties, and then it passes by.
And can you see where you're going now? Can you see the end stage, the route where you're going to take this wall into the building?
The end has been far more worked out than at any other stage because I have an end point. And how it engages with that point and is really is very, very different. I remember the beginning when we started, and then the wall separated. You know, there was this division, and it really felt like I think at the same time, like a ship leaving harbor. It's off on its journey. Mm-hmm. So it's been launched. Well, this is landing, and it feels like it's landing. So it's much more controlled or finding a route, and there's a tension in that because if you get it wrong, you're going to smack the harbor up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole feel of that, how it goes into the building, and there's been quite a bit of fairly vigorous discussions with the Nelson Atkins about how it goes in, because originally it was going to be quite an ambitious length inside. And the discussions, as they should be, as inevitably, have been quite tense. You know, mm-hmm. that's okay, you know, we're mm-hmm. in a bit of confrontation at times. And there was at one point when I threatened I wouldn't bring the wall in to the side. And the look of relief on everybody's face, I thought, oh, no, I'm going to really bring it inside. They're not going to get away with it. So, it is definitely coming inside.
And you see, I got to run, but you see the rock going right up against the glass?
It will go inside. It will go on both sides of the glass.
On both sides of the glass. And you'll be done by December 4th, you're saying?
It will be done by December the 4th.
And
evening of.
The evening of.
Yeah.
Will be a party?
There'll be. It is a kind of an event. Yeah,
I'll be there.
Great.
Andy, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for sharing all this stuff, and thanks for what you've done for our town. We sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much to Kansas City.
That's Andy Goldsworthy. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. We're off for the rest of the week. Join us Monday for a political rundown. We'll also dive into how the impeachment hearings are viewed in our part of the world. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Rhea Carter, Linda Scherer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.